elbows, then yanked it tight again. My shoulders pulled painfully off the floor. My pulse raced, my mind careening toward panic. What was happening? I could hear the boys conferring above me in Somali, sounding as if they were debating something. After a minute, they untied me and waved me back toward my mat, continuing their discussion all the while as if I weren't present. Sweating, I lay back down. Mohammed was pointing at a couple of pieces of rebar that protruded from a high spot on the wall, as if maybe they could hang something from them. Jamal twisted and tugged at my blue sheet, testing its strength. The three of them inspected everything in the room carefully, methodically. Without another glance in my direction, they left. I lay on my mat, knowing that something terrible was coming. I waited all day and the next. The following evening, they came back after sunset, after the fast was broken and dinner served. It was Mohammed and Abdullah this time. They closed the door behind them. Mohammed carried a bed sheet, a pale shade of yellow. It had been twisted up like a rope. He dropped it on the floor. I sat up on my mat. "Is everything okay?" I said. All I could see was that twisted sheet. Abdullah said, "Stand up." I got to my feet very slowly, the chains clinking between my ankles. I looked at their faces and saw nothing there, just blankness. My mind started leaping along with my heart ferreting for an escape. "I haven't prayed yet," I heard myself say. "I need to wash." The boys looked at each other. They could never argue with Islam. "Quickly," Abdullah said. Shuffling to the bathroom, I noticed that they'd closed the door to Nigel's room. Once inside, I stood at the open window, watching the buzzy pink light of the mosque in the distance, trying to steel myself against whatever was coming. The night was inky, starless. I could feel a low breeze. The dread I felt was primitive, animals racing for the hills, an ancient bell tolling loudly for the village to evacuate. They were going to hurt me, I knew. "Gather your strength," I told myself. "You need to be strong." Abdullah Mohammed waited outside the bathroom. They followed me back to my room, closed the door, and then sat against the wall as I prayed. I ran through the cycles of prayer as slowly and precisely as I could, hoping to lodge some reminder that I was like them. Finishing the last rak'ah, I commenced the silent prayer, one of the add-ons to regular prayers in which you praised Allah 100 times in your head. I was sliding a different set of words through my mind, as slowly as I possibly could. "Be strong, be strong, be strong, be strong." I repeated it 100 times over. When I was done, when all my options for stalling had been used up, I stood and turned to face the boys. Abdullah told me to lie on the floor, on my stomach, as I had 2 days earlier. With the yellow sheet, he bound my arms together just above the elbows and below my biceps. My shoulders and chest pulled up awkwardly, and I felt them jerk back even more. My whole torso arched. My feet were being pulled upward too, behind my back in the direction of my bound arms. I felt cloth winding around my ankles and suddenly a connected tension. I understood then what they had done. My hands and feet were roped together, pulling in opposite directions. I was immobilized. My body had been drawn into a taut bow. My muscles immediately started to scream. Mohammed tugged off my headscarf and tied it as a blindfold over my eyes, yanking it tight. My eyeballs instantly throbbed, the nerves behind them stabbed with pain. I saw white light. My head felt like it would pop. I was trussed like an animal. My panic was immediate. I couldn't last a minute this way. I couldn't even last a second. I couldn't form a thought beyond the pain of that position, my back straining from neck to tailbone. The twisted sheet dug into my arms and ankles, cutting off circulation. My lungs felt compressed. I struggled to breathe, gagging as if someone were pouring sand down my throat. "It's too tight," I shouted, my voice raspy and alien. "It's too tight." At some point, the boys left the room. Neither had uttered a word the whole time. What did they think about, the whole group of them, sitting outside my door during those first minutes, those first hours? Did they talk? Did they laugh? I'd never know. I was lost to everyone, drilled down into some underground place, trying to lift imaginary boulders, trying to pull up enough energy to get me through. Pain tore through my shoulders and back, searing the length of my spine. My neck bent toward the floor, my head unable to reach it and take away some of the strain. My thoughts warred. I can't bear this. You have to hang on. At some point in the dark of night, I heard the door open, some footsteps. I tried to form words, but they came out a strangled moan. I begged at the darkness, at whoever was there, to untie me. Something landed roughly on the small of my back, causing my muscles to seize up further. It was a foot. Whoever it was, he was tugging at the sheet, using his bare foot for leverage. I felt a new tension in my shoulders, my thighs lifting higher off the ground. He'd only come in to tighten the knots. By morning, I'd peed myself, having tried to hold it back as long as I could. I heard voices in the room. I knew they could smell the urine. Maybe they could see a puddle of it seeping from beneath my abaya. I couldn't tell what they were saying, but at first they sounded offended. Then somebody was laughing. I felt sure they were making jokes about who would have to clean it up. More hours passed. I lay awake and fully alert, my body stuck with hot pins. I tracked the calls of the muezzin, intoning in his minor key. Units of time had unfastened themselves from where they normally lived and were floating around me, big and small. I'd undergone another adjustment with the bindings. Someone had entered the room and wrapped what seemed to be a scarf around my neck, tying its ends into the sheet that kept my arms and legs in place so that any time my head started to sag, the tension on the scarf caused me to choke. They've studied this, I thought. They've consulted some manual on how to make a person suffer. I'd coached myself through a full year of captivity by breaking it into survivable pieces, telling myself to try to make it to the next day. When a day felt too big, I told myself to make it to the next prayer session or the next hour. Now, lost in the cacophony of my mind, I worked only to get myself to the next breath. The pain in my body had begun to blend, engulfing me like a swirling, pulsating star. Elbows, back, neck, knees, they'd all lost their distinction. I felt the pain every second. I was never unaware of it. But something else was happening, too. Some little compartment had hinged open in my mind like a perch. If I steadied myself enough, I could rest there. I could observe the pain more calmly. I still felt it, but I could feel it without needing to thrash, without feeling like I was drowning in it. When I didn't thrash, the time floated by a little more easily. Though I'd figured out how to balance on that perch, it was only for a few minutes at a time. The hurt in my body always wrenched me back, setting my brain screaming again. Every so often a voice cut into my thoughts, the same calming voice that always seemed to offer counsel, telling me I would be okay. This time, though I heard it, I couldn't believe it. I was wishing my captors would kill me so the pain would leave. Jamal came in at one point and removed my blindfold and the scarf that had been holding my neck. The light flooded my eyes. I begged him to help me, but he only looked at me coldly. "I am sorry," he said finally, his voice sounding flat. It seemed clear that he was not apologizing for himself. He was sorry I'd ended up in this situation, and that was it. They came and went. They fussed with the ropes. They put the blindfold on and then took it off. When I screamed for help, they shoved a sock in my mouth, forcing me to breathe through my nose. I must have lost consciousness because I woke to find Skids on his hands and knees before me, peering intently at my face, checking to see if I was alive. Twice on that second day, they rolled me over onto my back, on top of my tied arms and legs, which caused my blood to flow into all the parts of me that had gone dead. The sensation was excruciating, a blast of needling circulation, but it gave my limbs moments of relief. Each time, though, when they returned me to the stomach down position, the pain felt worse than ever. The calm voice tried to say things, but I argued with it now. "Breathe," it said. "I can't." "You're going to be okay." "I'm not. I'm going to die."
"You won't die. Keep breathing."
"I'm dying."
"No, you're not."
It was afternoon again, or that was my best guess. Muhammad and Abdullah came in and kicked at my ribs as I yowled into the sock. I floundered in the riptide of my own panic, my mind going limp with exhaustion. I knew I would die in that room. The pain was vivid to the point of being electric, electric to the point of being lightning on water. I couldn't get away from it. Then I felt a force whip through me like a strong gust of wind. It was like being seized by something, snatched, pulled upward. The pain was gone. I felt a bizarre, disembodied relief. Nothing at all hurt. I'd become unhitched, like a blown bit of dandelion drifting on a pillar of air. I was an observer, purely an observer, a self without a body. Maybe I'd died, I wasn't sure. I was high up in one corner, looking down at what was below. From above, I could see two men and a woman on the ground. The woman was tied up like an animal, and the men were hurting her, landing blows on her body. I knew all of them, but I also didn't. I recognized myself down there, but I felt no more connected to the woman than to the men in the room. I'd slipped across some threshold I would never understand. The feeling was both deeply peaceful and deeply sad. What I saw was three people suffering, the tortured and the torturers alike. Late on the third day, about 48 hours after it began, they untied me. I don't know who undid the knots or whether anything was said. I slumped forward onto the floor. The blindfold was pulled off. The gag came out of my mouth. Someone rolled me over. They picked me up by my arms and legs and tossed me heavily onto my mat. The sun had set and the house had gone dark. I could see Muhammad kicking me again and again, but I couldn't feel it. They were yelling things at me. I squinted at them through bleary eyes. The words seemed to pour from their mouths in slow motion. I could feel myself drenched in sweat. My arms lay like dead things on either side of me. Jamal loomed over me. He was holding a bottle of water. I opened my mouth and a curve of clear water arced toward it. Jamal poured half the bottle down my throat, the stream causing me to sputter and choke and to lift myself into a sitting position. Jamal was thrusting something new at me, a paper and pen. "Take, take," he was saying. They wanted me to write something down. My fingers couldn't grasp the pen. My hands were useless. I could see in the light of the boys' flashlights that they were a sickening shade of gray. Abdullah was dictating notes for a phone call. "Today, everything has changed. You tell your mom, everything has changed." I couldn't take in what they wanted me to say. I was in too much pain. I could hear the squawking of a phone on speaker being carried into the room. Skids held it to my face. Muhammad kicked one of my dead legs. The line crackled and spat, but my mother was on the other end.
"Amanda? Hello? Hello? Hello?" she said.
"Mummy."
"Amanda?"
"Mummy," I said, my head too drained to muster anything else, my need for her keener than it had ever been. "Mummy, mummy, 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 please." Chapter 42. The Bird. In the end, I said most of what they wanted me to say to my mother, though it was an effort just to form words. I said, as they had told me to, "Everything has changed," and I meant it. I told her I had been tied up and tortured. I told her I couldn't handle even one more day. She told me they'd offered Adam $500,000, but he wouldn't take it. Both of us wept the whole time on the phone. It felt like a farewell. When the call was over, Skids and the boys filed out of my room, leaving me alone on the mat with a half-empty bottle of water. Just before exiting, Abdullah looked back at me. "Tomorrow, we do to you again," he said. "Every day, until your mother pay, we do to you." He left the room. The words fell like concrete blocks. This wasn't the end of the torture. It was just a reprieve. They were going to come back and do it all over again. A blackness edged over me. I understood then what it means to feel hopeless, to despair, to feel no trace of faith in anything. They were going to tie me up again. I lay rigid on the mat as the blood flowed back into my joints with a rotating intensity. My mind stayed stuck on one thing. It was going to happen again. They would keep going. They would push and push at this impossible idea that our families had millions of dollars to pay. They would push for an eternity because to them, time didn't matter. Time on Earth was just time spent waiting for a chance at paradise. They had figured out how to destroy me without totally extinguishing me. They'd keep me alive till they got their cash. I heard a sound rise out of my lungs, a long, keening sob, more animal than human. Was this my life? It was. I was done. It would be better to die. This was the calmest thought I'd had in a long time. My razor, the straight edge my captors had given me months earlier to shave my pubic hair, had gone rusty in the humidity, its blades spittled with orange. But it could still cut. I knew that because I still used it. I kept the blade tucked in its paper sheath among my toiletries, the little fortress of bottles I'd lined up next to my mat. With some pressure on the razor, I was sure it could slice open my wrists. In the dark, I lay waiting for the sensation to come back to my hands. I curled and uncurled my fingers, feeling their function slowly return. I planned how it would go. I figured all I needed to do was jab myself hard and then rip the blade through the vein, right side first and then left. I guessed it wouldn't take more than 20 minutes beginning to end. With some satisfaction, I imagined the boys coming in and finding me half alive, but not being able to save me. It gave me pleasure to think I could watch them lose their fortune as I died. I decided I'd wait until the early morning to do it. I had spent hours, many hours, in the last year being hard on myself. I'd chastised myself for the life I'd led, for all the self-indulgent things I'd done. I'd berated myself for having run stupidly into Somalia, for having empty ambitions, for believing I was invincible. I'd been mad at myself for never telling my mother that I forgave her for the ugliness of my childhood. I regretted the years I'd spent hating my body, starving it to stay thin. I wanted another chance to do all of it better, but now I accepted that it wouldn't come. With that acceptance, I felt something different, soothing. A peace, a receding of my regrets, a low tide sliding back to leave a skirt of glittering beach. Had I lived a life? I had. Had I seen the world? I had. I'd done things. I'd loved people. I'd seen beauty. I'd been fortunate. I was grateful. By the time the first thin light slipped through the cracks in my shutters, I had thought, person by person, through my family and my friends, through everyone I thought I would miss when I was dead. I felt saddest about Nigel, for leaving him there alone in Somalia. In my mind, I asked his forgiveness, his and everyone's, for not trying to live longer. I'd sent love and hoped that somehow it would translate from my place on the mat, up over the oceans and continents to where each of them was. I cried a little, but I also felt ready. It was time. What I wanted was to die quickly. I could hear beyond my doorway the sound of the boys sleeping out in the reception area, the occasional unconscious snort or sigh. The muezzin, I knew, was probably lifting himself from bed now, trundling through the dark toward the mosque with its pink neon to make his first call of the morning. Mornings, for me, had always been the most difficult, the drowsy moment when dream sorted itself from fact, when I woke just enough to realize the chains around my ankles. Sometimes I touched them to confirm that they were real. I reached for the razor, and once it was in my hand, I lay back down, waiting another minute to make the first cut. This is it, I thought. But before I made a move, I felt a curious warm sensation spreading from the top of my head down through my body, like a liquid being poured into me. It relaxed me completely, making me feel as if I were melting into the mat. I didn't feel any pain. I felt like I was pooling into something larger, connecting me to a new source of strength. Images flashed through my mind. Beaches, mountaintops, the street I'd lived on with my mom and dad for the first 6 years of my life, almost as if I were being taken on a rapid-fire trip. Its clarity was piercing. I felt a serious longing to see it all again, to be a part of it. Something moved in the doorway. The early sun at a window in the reception area had washed a pale square of daylight onto the floor of my otherwise dark room. In the middle of it was a small brown bird, something like a sparrow, hopping back and forth on the dirty floor, cocking its head and pecking at the ground. The bird looked up, seeming to study the room and me in it. A moment later, it lifted off the ground and in a flurry of feathers was gone, flying through the door, back into the reception area, out toward the sky. I hadn't seen a bird in nearly a year. I'd always believed in signs, in charms and talismans, in messengers and omens and angels. And now, when it mattered most, I had one. I would live and go home. It didn't matter what came next or what I had to endure. I would make it through. I believed it with a sureness I hadn't felt since the beginning. Chapter 43, A Notebook and a Promise. Ramadan finished. Our captors slaughtered a goat, ate it, and moved us again to a house far out in the country, away from Kismayu and the coastline, somewhere back toward Mogadishu. Bush House, I called it. The house had a big sandy yard with two broken trucks rusting in one corner and a high stone wall that surrounded the whole place. A row of ragged trees grew on the other side. Skids and the boys had not come back to tie me up the next day. The abrasions around my elbows and ankles slowly began to heal. A few days after I'd been untied, Skids had tossed a plastic bag into my room. Inside the bag were two new dresses, folded neatly, made of thin cotton in bright floral prints. They were a gift, an acknowledgement that I'd suffered. I sensed a lingering guilt among my captors over what had happened. Hassam and Jamal avoided me completely for several days. The others focused on the new dresses, asking me to try them on, complimenting me when I did, telling me I looked like a Somali woman. In truth, the fabric was too thin to feel comfortable. I felt exposed in the dresses and never wore them for long, sticking instead to the heavy red dress I'd worn for so long. Abdullah showed up in my room one day and gave me a small plastic tub of perfumed body lotion, telling me proudly that he'd paid for it himself. "From Germany," he said. It seemed his way of appeasing his own guilt. I opened the tub and sniffed it, but never once put it on my body. Romeo had not been present in the house during the days I was tied up. When I told him what had happened, he pretended to be surprised, but I could tell from his expression that he was fully aware. It was possible, even, that he'd been the one to issue the order. As the weeks passed, he'd grown increasingly morose. Allah, it turned out, had not wanted him to go to graduate school in New York after all. His departure date came and went, with no money surfacing for a plane ticket. His fate was to stay with me and Nigel and the boys and Skids, to keep waiting. We spent about 6 weeks in the Bush house, long enough that, through the bathroom window, I watched a sea of green wheat sprout and grow tall in the backyard, swallowing up the two trucks. It was raining again, the start of another season. Romeo threw himself into teaching me to recite the Quran. He brought me Nigel's copy to study, leaving it with me overnight. Beginning from the back of the book, where the chapters were shorter, I learned the verses, usually 5 or 6 lines at a stretch, slowly working my way into longer passages until I could chant 30 lines at a time in halting Arabic. Allah is the light of the heavens and the earth. The parable of his light is as if there were a niche and within it a lamp. The lamp enclosed in glass, the glass as it were a brilliant star. Sometimes Romeo laughed at my pronunciation. Every so often he'd slap me if I got something wrong, but once in a while I'd hit some benchmark and make him proud. He'd summon the boys into my room so that I could chant for them, not unlike a prize canary. "You see," Romeo would say to the boys, as if proving a point. "Amina is a good Muslim woman." This always seemed to be the debate. The Quran was traveling regularly from Nigel's room to mine and back, along with a hardcover book of hadith. I was allowed to sit up on my mat while reading them. When Romeo wasn't around, Hassam came and gave me my lessons. He seemed contrite over what had happened and went out of his way to check on me, bringing me tablets of ibuprofen and stealing back to my room once in a while with an extra cup of tea. He also allowed me to have a couple of the books that had come months earlier in the care package, sneaking them to me for a few hours at a time. To help with my Quranic studies, he brought me a pen, a pencil, and a thin, unlined notebook with mint green covers, the UNICEF logo emblazoned on the front. Catching sight of the notebook one afternoon, Abdullah tore it out of my hands and waved it in my face. "Do you know what this is?" he said in a seething voice. He was pointing at the logo, a mother in profile holding a young child against the backdrop of a globe. I said, "UNICEF?" His finger moved from mother to child. He looked at me emphatically. "Very bad." He carried the notebook off, leaving me despondent. So far, I'd used it only to write down a few questions I wanted to ask Romeo or Hassam about the Quran, but it had mattered to me. The milk white of those pages, the freedom of making even a simple query visible in ink. About 20 minutes later, Abdullah returned, throwing the notebook onto the floor with disdain. He'd taken a marker and scribbled big black slashes over the mother and child, abiding by the Prophet's rule that living beings were not to be displayed in artwork. Now it was okay to use. I spent hours staring at that notebook, daring myself to record a real thought in it, worried that Romeo, the only one who could read English, would ask to see it. In the meantime, I noticed that Nigel had used a pencil to underline some of the English verses in his Quran. On a blank page at the end of the book, he kept notes, a simple list of page numbers marking verses I assumed he wanted to revisit. What he'd underlined concerned captives and laws about behavior. It seemed that Nigel, like me, had been using the Quran to argue for better treatment. I decided to try something. I paged through the book, skimming the English, looking for individual words with which to make a message. When I found one, I'd underline the whole passage, surrounding it lightly in pencil, but under the word I wanted him to notice, I'd make a firmer, more distinct line, almost as if drawing an arrow to it. I picked one word, then another, and then, at the back of the book, next to Nigel's notes, I wrote down an ordered list of the page numbers on which they could be found. Later that afternoon, I told Hassam I was finished studying the Quran for the day. I watched him scuttle out the door with the book, trusting that he would bring it to Nigel. The message I'd sent went like this. I love you. My mother says they have 500,000. The next day, when the Quran came back to me, I waited until I was alone and then flipped to the end of the book. Nigel had jotted down a new string of page numbers. My heart leaping, I whipped through the corresponding pages, hunting for the references. He'd understood the code and responded. I want home. I despise men. During the weeks we spent in the Bush house, we were getting mixed signals about what was going on at home, whether any progress was being made. Nigel and I had been allowed a few quick, scripted phone calls. I'd overheard snippets of one conversation Nigel had with his sister Nikki, in which she told him the family had sold 2 houses and a couple of cars. One day Romeo came into my room, trailed by all the boys. He said, "There's one chance. Your mother has $500,000, and if she pays tomorrow, we accept that." He added, "She can pay for you only, not Nigel. His family has money and she is poor, but she decides today if she will save you." Moments later, his phone rang, a call being patched in from Adam, with my mother on the line. "Make her understand you have only this chance," Romeo said. He gestured toward the boys, standing tall with their guns, and shrugged. "After this, I cannot say what they will do to you." With Romeo holding the phone in front of my face, I repeated his message. I begged my mother to get me out, even if it meant me alone. It crushed me to say the words. I knew Nigel would be able to hear parts of the conversation. I hoped he'd understand that this was just another manipulation. Romeo was trying to assess how much money my family had. But my mother was resolute. "The families were working together," she said. "They had $500,000 for both of us. There was nothing more they could offer." Romeo then left the house, replaced for a few days by Ahmed, who arrived in his car, clean-shaven and in city clothes, a polo shirt and pressed pants. He brought a new proof of life question for me. "What is your father's favorite color?" And did not hide his disgust at the squalor in which we were all living. Seeing that my feet were swollen and scabbed from mosquito bites, he ordered the boys to hang my mosquito net over my mat. I'd had it in my belongings all along, but hadn't been allowed to use it since the time we'd escaped, 9 months earlier. It was less an act of goodwill on Ahmed's part and more, I figured, added insurance that I wouldn't get sick and die on him. Skids had fallen ill with malaria and spent his days curled in a ball on the floor. In order to reach the bathroom, I had to pass by where he lay, writhing in fever in the main room of the house. He looked hunched and craven, his bald head gleaming with sweat. I hoped he would die. "Hunter green," I said to Ahmed. "My father's favorite color." I asked if he could give me an update on the negotiations, whether we would go home soon. Ahmed shook his head vigorously and delivered some chilling news. The group, he said, had given up on reaching an agreement with our families and was working instead to strike a deal to sell us to Al-Shabaab. Shabaab would then sell us back to our families. He passed me a few pages of paper and a pen and ordered me to write out a statement for him, something he referred to as the promise. In it, I was to declare that wherever I ended up, I would adhere to the tenets of Islam and promote the faith. If I were freed, I needed to find a way to send him $500,000 for jihad. He wanted me to put into writing exactly how I'd raise the money. I thought about it a minute and then wrote down that I'd start a jihadi website for profit and write a book that promoted Islam for women. Knowing how he loved documents, I used as much official-sounding language as I could, dropping in words like hereby and herewith, in case that would help tip the balance toward our release. At the bottom, I put a signature. Amina Lindhout. Ahmed looked the whole thing over and told me it was good. Before leaving, he said, "Inshallah, your situation will be better soon." I didn't believe him for a second. If they struck a deal with Shabaab, it would not be better. I felt sure, in fact, that things were about to get worse. I took a chance, finally, and wrote something personal in the UNICEF notebook. I'd lived with a notebook for about a month. It had become a temptation I could no longer resist. Having the tools to write and not using them was like sitting in front of a meal and not eating it, even though I was starving. So one day I did it. I sat on my mat with the notebook flipped open in front of me, ready to slide it out of sight if anyone came into the room. I drew the blue mosquito netting around me like a curtain. Then I wrote a sentence, taking care to keep my writing so small that if any of my captors looked at it, they wouldn't be able to read it. My words, as they accumulated, looked like the writing of a lunatic, like strings of tiny pearls packed onto the page. I phrased what I wrote as a letter to my mother, a one-way conversation. I told her about my days. I described how I passed the time by escaping in my mind, how, if I needed to use the bathroom, I had to bang an empty water bottle on the floor to get my captor's permission. I wrote about being hungry and lonely, and about the regrets that gathered at the edges of my mind each day, asking to be reviewed. The two things I deliberately didn't mention were religion and the abuse I'd suffered at the hands of my captors, knowing that those, more than anything, would get me punished if the journal were found. Writing felt like a defiance, an outlet, a vein opened up. I kept the notebook hidden under my mat and wrote in it almost daily, usually when the boys lazed around in their mid-afternoon torpor, always with the Quran or the Book of Hadith open on my lap so I could pretend to be studying. The guilt streamed out of me, old memories firing at close range. I wrote about how, years earlier in Afghanistan, during my first attempts at being a journalist, I'd visited a big prison outside of Kabul and in the women's wing had met a Sudanese woman who'd been arrested and sentenced to 8 years in prison for attempting to smuggle heroin. She shared a cell with five other women. I'd take note that the room was clean, that they had their own small bathroom. I remembered thinking, well, this isn't so bad. The Sudanese woman was heavy set and wore a flowered dress. She had corn-rowed hair and her eyes struck me as sad and empty. She had been the only prisoner in the cell who spoke English. She'd talked to me urgently, desperately, as if telling me her story would help get her out. I'm sorry for what I did, she told me. I want to go home. My reply was something I now regretted deeply. The words of a young woman who knew nothing, understood nothing. I'd said something like, yes, but you have to pay the consequence of your crime. I'd given her no consolation. I'd only shamed her. The memory of it burned painfully in my mind. To my mother in the journal, I wrote, I wonder sometimes if this has happened to me because I have been such a thoughtless person. I also made what was the very beginning of a larger vow. I wonder, when I am free again, how I can help oppressed people. I owe it to everyone to make my life into something. Our next move was to a ramshackle village. I could understand enough of the boys' chatter to know we were now just outside of Mogadishu. Skids, the boys, and Nigel stayed in a grubby concrete house, while I was put in a windowless attached storage room, which, judging from the droppings that littered the floor, recently held goats. The fact that we'd moved nearer to the city might have made me feel hopeful, closer, even just a little bit, to a world I could recognize. In a different state of mind, I might have imagined the Mogadishu airport, the place Nigel and I had flown into 2 summers ago, feeling thrilled by the first canted glimpse we'd had of Somalia's golden coastline, the low-lying, unexplored city beyond. I might have listened for the sound of planes flying overhead and tried to calculate the distance between me and that tarmac, as Nigel and I had done so carefully before we'd escaped. But I didn't. I'd had my hopes raised and then dashed so many times now. I couldn't dream myself out of the leg shackles and over the wall surrounding the property, and into a car driven by someone, anyone, who didn't fear or hate me, who would take me to a waiting plane. To my chagrin, Skids had made a full recovery from his malaria, though the toll on his body was evident. He no longer looked like a militia captain, but rather like a stooping dowager. The whole group seemed to wear the time more heavily. Hassam, who had always been small-framed, looked emaciated, swallowed up by his clothing. Romeo no longer lived with us. He'd come for a last visit while we were at Bush House, having abandoned all discussions about school or marriage. He'd talked only about the impending deal with Al-Shabaab. If it worked, the transaction would allow his group to pay off debts and turn a small profit. There were new men, he said, who couldn't wait to own us. According to Romeo, Al-Shabaab had enough money to keep us alive and wait for the full ransom amount. They could hold out for 10 years or longer, he said. We cannot do this anymore, Amina, Romeo had told me, shrugging. I'm sorry about your luck. One evening, shortly after the 6 p.m. prayer, the door to the shed flanged open, revealing Skids Abdullah Muhammad. The three of them had their faces wrapped in scarves. They were holding guns. My heart whirred. I knew it was time. A day or so earlier, as if signaling an end, Hassam had passed me a scrap of paper with his email address written on it. Hassam123 was his handle. Maybe one day, inshallah, you will write me, he'd said. Skids had me hobble inside the house, where I was given a new abaya, a thick gray satin thing, to wear over my jeans, and then he waved me back outside toward an SUV parked in the driveway. When I reached the car, he gestured for me to sit on the pavement. Abdullah produced a small bow saw and began to hack at the two padlocks that bound the chains to my ankles. He sawed wordlessly, shifting from one leg to the other, the sweat dripping from his face onto my feet, the links twisting into my flesh with a bruising force. It seemed they'd lost the keys. The saw blade grazed my ankle as Abdullah worked. Everyone around us was tense. I heard cell phones ringing. My captors came and went from the house, propelled by an urgency I didn't understand. Skids peered down impatiently at my legs, tracking Abdullah's progress with the saw. Eventually, Jamal came out, also wrapped in scarves, and took a turn, having me sit in the back seat of the car with the door open so he'd have better leverage. One padlock fell away. My ankle was so numb, I felt no difference. As Jamal started work on the groove Abdullah had put in the second padlock, Nigel emerged from the house, limping in my direction. His chains had been removed. He was wearing a clean shirt and new jeans and moving clumsily. His gaze stayed fixed on the ground. Just as my other foot was freed, he was pushed into the other side of the car. I figured the new clothing and removed chains represented an attempt to spruce up the merchandise before they passed us on to Al-Shabaab, to show that we were worth the money paid for us. Nearly every one of the boys piled into the vehicle, while Skids took the wheel. Ahmed, I could see, was leading in a car up ahead. We commenced another swerving ride through the desert. Nigel and I said nothing to each other. Quietly, I began to cry. The sun was setting, and I remember how purple the land looked. I remember my stomach heaving with fear. At some unnameable place, some characterless sandy path, we pulled over. Nigel and I were pushed hurriedly into another car, this one holding two Somali men we'd never seen. Ahmed tapped a finger on my window 3 times, indicating I should roll it down. When I did, he bent to look at me. "Don't forget the promise," he said. Romeo also appeared, holding Nigel's Quran, passing it to him through the window. And then the new car took off, me, Nigel, and the two silent strangers, rocketing into the darkness before anyone could say a word. Nigel and I held hands, hiding our touch beneath the folds of my billowy new abaya. He kept his other hand resting on the Quran in his lap. We'd been passed to Al-Shabaab, I was certain of it. I felt as if I were falling through space, as if I'd stepped off the top of a skyscraper and was plummeting with nothing to reach out for, my mind unable to catch on to one thought. I fell and fell and fell, so fast I was tingling, so fast it was all blackness. until the car lurched to a halt and we were tugged out into the night. 40 or more gunmen surrounded us in the darkness, shouting and waving, many of them hidden behind scarves. I felt shock, exhaustion. It was happening all over again. I clung to the open door of the car as some of the men pulled at my legs, trying to tear me away. It had been 10 months since I'd taken a single full step without shackles on my legs. I stumbled and fell as they pushed me toward yet another car, an SUV parked with its headlights on by the side of the road. Men yelled and clamored and pointed guns at us. I was sobbing, screaming words I didn't recognize, batting at whoever's hands were near me. I was shoved into the back seat of the SUV. Nigel, who'd also put up a fight, had been thrust in ahead of me. "I can't believe this is happening," I was saying. "I can't believe this is happening." Next to me, Nigel looked terrified. The car doors slammed shut. We were surrounded by a new set of men, two sitting in the front seat, one in the back. I caught the faintest whiff of a long-forgotten scent, cigarette smoke. Someone in the car was a smoker. A realization bubbled from the recesses of my rational mind. A fundamentalist wouldn't smoke. The men in the car didn't belong to Al-Shabaab. A gray-haired Somali man appeared at the window, a cell phone pressed to his ear. He leaned in and inspected us. He had a close-cropped beard and wide brown eyes and was the spitting image of the actor Morgan Freeman, as if he'd stepped right out of some movie set and was now standing alongside a car parked in the Somali desert, watching me sob. His expression was impassive, confused. "Why are you crying?" he said. He passed me his phone. "Here, talk to your mother." And there was her voice, closer than it had ever sounded, my lifeline back to the world. "Hello, hello," she said. "Amanda, you're free." Chapter 44, Beginning to Understand. What came next felt both unreal and yet utterly vivid. Our captors, it turned out, had handed us over to a group of intermediaries, who then passed us on to the man standing at the side of our car, the man we began referring to as Morgan Freeman. He was a member of the Somali Parliament and was being paid by AKE, the security firm our families had hired. Working by phone over several weeks with John Chase, AKE's director, Morgan Freeman had helped arrange for the delivery of ransom, $600,000, transferred from Nairobi to a banking kiosk in Mogadishu earlier that day. Our families had been assured that a receipt for the money would be handed to some group of tribal elders, which, in a country lacking police, organized military, or a well-functioning government, constituted the only authority available. Once it was confirmed that Nigel and I were safe, the elders would withdraw the money and pass it on to the kidnappers, minus whatever debts were owed to other militia groups and presumably keeping some for themselves. Nobody here worked for free. The plan that night was for me and Nigel to go directly to the airport in Mogadishu, where the same chartered plane and two men working for AKE, both of them former Special Forces soldiers, one from New Zealand, one from Zimbabwe, waited to take us to safety in Kenya. But Morgan Freeman had made a critical mistake, failing to alert African Union peacekeeping forces that we'd be driving through the darkness to the airport, which was normally closed at that hour. When we turned down the road, the troops guarding the airport opened fire on our vehicle. We were forced to reverse direction and drive back toward the city. It didn't matter that I'd spoken with my mother. It didn't matter that our captors appeared to be long gone. We were still in a car, hurtling at a panicky high speed. We were still in Somalia, still surrounded by armed strangers. No part of me trusted that we were free. After a while, the car skidded to a halt in front of a tall gate, and we were ushered into the open air. "Come, come," Morgan Freeman was saying, waving us through a door inside the gate. My legs felt like stumps beneath me, unaccustomed to motion, let alone moving quickly. I fell twice trying to reach that door. Nigel stumbled too. The two of us held on to each other, our arms intertwined. Through the door was a garden filled with manicured shrubs and a patio restaurant where Somali businessmen sat at plastic tables, eating dinner under the stars. We were at a hotel, a place to spend the night, waiting for morning, when it would be safer to reattempt the airport drive. The businessmen on the patio gaped as we wobbled past. Nigel and I were rushed through the hotel reception area and into a ballroom filled with couches. Framed paintings of Mecca and ornate renderings of Islamic text hung on the walls. "Please, please, here," Morgan Freeman was saying, directing us toward a red love seat in the center of the room. The room began to fill, men drifting in and surrounding us. Some wanted to shake our hands. A number of them spoke English, saying they'd heard bits of gossip about us over the months, the hostages who'd tried to escape. Several introduced themselves as officials with the transitional government. Many jumped on their phones, appearing to be spreading the news. "You are safe," the hotel manager kept saying. "You are safe." He told me I could take off my headscarf, but I didn't dare. A uniformed waiter materialized before us, offering two dewy bottles of Coca-Cola on a tray. Nigel and I stared, not quite bold enough to reach for them. When you have spent 15 months having every move monitored and controlled, the first glimmers of independence can leave you stunned. Both Nigel and I were too afraid to behave in any way like Westerners. "Allahu Akbar," we said to the men in the hotel ballroom when they congratulated us on our freedom. "Inshallah, we will soon go home." Eventually, the hotel manager led us to two rooms on the same hallway. He read the anxiety on our faces and kept repeating, as if it would mitigate it, that he had relatives in the United States. He gave us each clean towels and soap, toothbrushes and toothpaste. He handed me a fresh-smelling flowered dress that belonged to his wife. Alone in the room, I felt like an alien landed on a new planet. A ceiling fan rotated overhead. The double bed held two pillows and faced a small television. Curtains were drawn over the windows. I locked the door and pushed the bedside table in front of it for good measure. In the bathroom, I turned the knobs on the sink to confirm there was running water. I then peeled off the gray dress my captors had given me only hours earlier. Standing naked in front of the full-length mirror, I looked at myself for the first time in many months, and was aghast at what I saw. My body was all bones. My skin looked waxy, so pale it had a bluish tint. My hair dangled in thin strands past my breasts, longer than it had ever been, and dark after months hidden away from the sun. My ankles were ringed with purple bruises where the shackles had been. It was like looking at a stranger. In the shower, I put the water on as hot as it would go, scrubbing myself all over. I did everything hurriedly, believing that the luxury of washing was something I'd lose at any moment. I clutched the bar of soap, feeling a little war going on in my mind. "Slow down, you're safe." "No, I'm not." "Yes, really, you are." Afterward, Nigel and I sat together on my bed in the room. I tried to comb the knots from my hair, but it fell out in clumps, so I'd given up. He, too, had showered and donned fresh clothes. His beard remained an untrimmed monstrosity. The officious hotel manager delivered us a couple of chicken sandwiches. Like the Cokes, they looked almost too strange to touch. Nigel and I held hands and talked, which in itself felt like a miracle. We were shy around each other, steeped in our individual uncertainties, hit by the night's surrealism. Were we really going home? Were our captors truly gone? When we heard a muezzin call go up for the final prayer and other hotel guests rustling down the hallway, we debated whether we should join the men in the ballroom and make a show of praying. In the end, we opted to stay in the room. That we made a choice and weren't punished for it felt like a second miracle. Nigel and I talked through much of the night, neither of us interested in sleep. He asked questions about what had happened to me, about the extent to which I'd been abused, but I wasn't ready to discuss any of it with him. Everything felt too raw. We joked lightly about how we'd never eat bananas again or canned tuna. We shared bits and pieces of information about the months after we'd been separated. Nigel had been allowed books and writing materials during his months of isolation. He'd been shackled throughout, but never tied up and tortured as I had been. We reconciled ourselves to the fact that as a man, he'd received better treatment right through. We flipped on the television in the room and were startled to see a news story about our release playing on Press TV, the network I'd worked for in Baghdad. The next morning, we flew out of Somalia, 463 days after we arrived, lifting away from the glittering coastline that at first glance had struck me as gorgeous, away from the city I'd once mistaken for calm. Landing in Nairobi, we were met on the tarmac by representatives from the Canadian and Australian embassies. I was put into a vehicle with little Canadian flags flapping from the side mirrors, and Nigel was loaded into an official-looking car of his own. Sirens blaring, we were driven to the Aga Khan University Hospital nearby. The first person I spotted was my mother, waiting for me in the sunshine on the curb. She looked a little thin but beautiful. I was struck by how beautiful she was, in fact. It was as if time had folded in half, putting us back together as if nothing had ever happened. When she embraced me, we both wept hard. I rested my head in the crook of her neck. She rubbed my shoulders with one hand and kept the other pressed firmly against the back of my head. It felt like shelter. It felt like home. She said the same thing over and over. You made it. You made it. You made it. At the hospital, Nigel and I were given rooms in a private wing where we stayed for a week. His family, his mother and sister, had come to be with him. My father, too, flew to Nairobi, along with my old friend and traveling companion Kelly Barker, whose hair I had cut on the lakefront dock in Guatemala all those years earlier. Kelly, it turned out, had been a huge source of strength and a confidant for my mom while I was in captivity, driving from Calgary to visit, bringing her meals. After AKE was hired, Kelly had become part of the official crisis management team, joining weekly Skype calls with John Chase and our families to discuss the case. In my hospital room, I was tended by nurses, doctors, and a female psychologist who specialized in trauma and had been flown in from Canada. I was treated for dehydration and malnourishment, put on an IV, and given a battery of tests. A dentist examined my broken and abscessed teeth. One of the first things I requested was to have my hair cut short, ridding myself of the inches acquired in captivity. I'd spent so many months fantasizing about food, imagining the day when I could choose what to eat, and then eat until I was full, and now it had arrived. The nurses brought me a menu before each meal. The first few days, I wanted everything all at once. Even as the doctors told me to take it easy, they didn't try to stop me from indulging, knowing I needed, in that moment, to exercise this most visceral form of freedom. I ordered chicken breast, pasta, vegetables, French fries, fruit, cake, and pie with ice cream. My heart boiled over with desire, but my body wasn't ready for any of it. My stomach cramped viciously after eating. I couldn't keep much down. One afternoon, Kelly showed up bearing a bag of food she'd bought in a fancy Nairobi supermarket, an extravaganza of gourmet cheeses and Cadbury chocolate. I'd always been an insatiable cheese and chocolate eater. She'd teased me about it as we'd traveled together through so many humid rice-eating countries where such rich foods were scarce. Now, in the hospital room, we both laughed at the memories. But within moments, I was in tears. I knew that eating any of what she'd brought would only make me sick. The frustration I felt echoed something larger I was only just beginning to understand. I was caught in a time lag. I was free, but I wasn't yet well. That first week was something of a blur, not unlike a gradual waking from a nightmare. From the cloud of a soft bed, I'd open my eyes in the morning and feel a rush of disbelief. The pillow under my head, my mother sleeping on the couch nearby, a hairbrush set on the table, the vases full of flowers sent by well-wishers, the stretch of morning sky outside my window. All of it seemed illusory, capable of vanishing.